You're listening to Law and Justice on UCC 98.3 FM. I'm Jane Mulcahy, and this is the very first show that we are going to be presenting new material about issues relating to law, norms, justice, social justice, government policy, that type of thing. We have a varied show lined up for you today, dealing largely with penal matters. So we have a segment from UCC's own Fiona Donson, who works in the law school. And she and her colleague Dr. Aisling Parks were working on a project to do with children affected by imprisonment. And I recorded an interview with Fiona earlier about Unseen Unheard, which was an event that they coordinated at the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission in conjunction with the Irish Penal Reform Trust and the Children's Rights Alliance. So we'll have that, followed by a segment on solitary confinement. There was an event in Trinity College Dublin last night, and a speaker from the US, Jules Lobel, who gave some insights into litigation that he undertook on behalf of detainees who'd been subject to very lengthy periods of solitary confinement. We'll be discussing data protection issues and a Cork Chamber of Commerce event, and we'll also have someone from the Law Society here at UCC in to discuss some upcoming events that the Law SOC are going to be engaged with. So we can look forward to that. I get up in the evening, and I ain't got nothing to say. I come home in the morning, I go to bed feeling the same way. I ain't nothing but tired. Radio's on and I'm moving around the place. I check my look in the mirror. Wanna change my clothes, my hair, my face, and I ain't getting nowhere. I'm just living in a dump like this. There's something happening somewhere. Baby, I just know. You're listening to Law and Justice with Jane Mulcahy on Tuesday, the 19th of September, 2017. It's the first show. Just to give you a bit of background about Unseen Unheard, Dr. Fiona Donson and Dr. Aisling Park secured Irish Research Council funding to research the effects and consequences, I suppose, of parental imprisonment on a child. And they were coming very much from a child rights point of view, because in prisons are geared towards the security of adult offenders, and they are very conscious of maintaining safety and security and the rights of other people, in this instance children who might be coming to visit a parent in prison, are not uppermost in their minds, and visiting conditions are not always suitable for children. For a very long time there were no contact visits in this country. We know very little, in fact, about the numbers of children who even have a parent or family member in prison. This is because there are some data protection considerations, and also because up until comparatively recently, it just wasn't on the radar of the prison administrations at all. So Dr. Fiona Donson and Dr. Aisling Parks got this funding and attended a variety of international conferences, liaised with the Irish Penal Reform Trust, which is Ireland's leading NGO on prison-related matters, and the Children's Rights Alliance, which is an umbrella organisation that promotes the interests of children and very much was behind, you know, promoting the children's referendum a few years ago, and engages a lot with organisations to ensure that the voice of children is heard in decisions that affect them. Working recently on a project called Unseen Unheard. Can you tell me a little bit about that project, please?
Myself and my colleague, Dr. Aisling Parks, were given Irish Research Council funding last year to develop a project working with two NGOs. So we worked with the Irish Penal Reform Trust and the Children's Rights Alliance. And the purpose of the project was to gather knowledge from international good practice and then use it to develop what we initially thought of as an advocacy policy or an advocacy strategy. But it changed somewhat into a kind of development of good principles in how to encourage government to formally recognise and engage with children who are affected by having a parent in the prison system.
And why did you identify this group of children as being particularly worthy of study? Are there major gaps in this area, or do we not know a lot about them in Ireland?
Yes, so children who have a parent in prison are a vulnerable group, and they're recognised in some jurisdictions as a clear vulnerable group. But we don't have any real direct recognition of them as that vulnerable group in Ireland. They are briefly referenced in one of the Department of Children and Youth Affairs policies, the Better Outcomes, Brighter Futures document, but only in relation to prison visits. One of the things that we found from other jurisdictions is that, of course, children who have a parent in prison can experience multiple difficulties, not just in relation to going to visit their parent in prison, but throughout the system, whether it be from the arrest by the Gardaí through into their education, childcare arrangements in the home, homelessness potentially, loss of income, mental health issues. So this covers a whole range of policy areas that we really wanted to highlight needed to be kind of dealt with on a kind of cross-governmental level. The Irish Penal Reform Trust had written a report back in 2012 called Picking Up the Pieces, which was probably the first real national level engagement with this issue around this group of children. A very good report written by Michelle Martin, who actually worked with us. She was working and is currently working with the Irish Penal Reform Trust. So they were an obvious partner. And the Children's Rights Alliance is the key children's organisation in the country and has a very good reputation, super organisation. And it's a membership organisation, so there are lots of smaller organisations come within their umbrella. And one of the things that we were keen to do was to stress that this was a children's issue, not a criminal justice issue, not a prisons issue solely, but a children's issue. So bringing both of them on board made sense to us, to get them to really engage and embrace and to take a lead, I suppose, at the NGO level, whereas we can take a lead to some extent, but we're academics and researchers. So working with them brought together all sorts of positives and kind of strengths. And they have different strengths to us.
And there was an event then in Dublin recently held at the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. Can you tell me a little bit about that event? Who was speaking at it, Fiona?
Yep, so that event was the kind of culmination of it's only a 9-month project. And as part of the project, we went to a couple of big international conferences. So we took people from the Irish Penal Reform Trust and the Children's Rights Alliance with us. And we went to a big international conference in New Zealand and a European conference in Naples and gathered together examples of good practice, best practice from around the world. And what we then did when we came back was develop principles of action for children with a parent in prison. So rather than, as I said at the beginning, an advocacy strategy, we decided that what we wanted to do was focus on what we believed government should be doing and other organisations should be doing at a national level. So these are our kind of recommendations of how things should proceed to really raise this group of children from, you know, local and important interventions, but to recognise them in national policy and national strategy. So we very much focused on the Department of Children and Youth Affairs as a kind of key organisation to lead this. But we've also recognised, and what we've also become involved in, is this drafting of a Council of Europe recommendation, which is coming down the line. So we had a speaker from the Council of Europe, Elena Teneva. She came to talk about their engagement with this, and we also brought over Tim Haynes, who is an officer working for Families Outside, which is a fabulous Scottish organisation, and he came to talk about education. So they do wonderful training of teachers. They take teachers into the prison and expose them to the visiting system and expose them to the challenges that this group of children experience. So a really super kind of project to make people think about the kinds of things that are happening out there. We also had Fergal Black from the Prison Service and Fergal Landy from Tusla to talk about what their organisations are already doing to try and respond to this group.
And are the Irish Prison Service and Tusla very engaged on this issue now, or is it a work in progress, do you think? And what needs to be done further, I suppose, to put children's interests more at the centre of practice?
We would commend the Irish Prison Service for stepping up. So when the report was published by the Irish Penal Reform Trust in 2012, the Prison Service recognised that they had to do something to improve visiting conditions and to improve the bonds between parents in prison and the children outside. And they created policy and they've developed parenting programmes, and they have shown a strong commitment. Having said that, it's very definitely a work in progress, and they themselves talk about it being a journey. from our perspective, we would want a lot more, but of course we would always want a lot more. We feel that the prison service is still struggling with the kind of tension between security and not really recognising the children as rights holders in this situation. They tend to focus more on the prisoner, which is unsurprising because that's their primary focus. But what we want them to do is to recognise that as a state body, they have a responsibility to these children, not just as an adjunct to their parents. So that's the prison service. As I say, very definitely things have improved and things will continue to improve. And we welcome that and we would be pushing them to continue that. Tuzla have a lot of vulnerable children within their care and within their services. We would say that there's some very good practice developing. It's recently started to develop. We again, though, want that to be recognised at the kind of senior levels within Tuzla and within their policy documents. So one of the things that we welcome with the prison service is that they have developed a policy, which then needs to be implemented down. One of our concerns is you get pockets of good practice, but if it's not within a policy document of an organisation such as Tuzla, implementation is intermittent and it's very much reliant upon the individuals who are driving it. And as I say, there are fabulous individuals working, but you can't just rely on them being there. You need it embedded within the organisation. So we would be strongly urging them to continue their work, but also getting them to kind of seek a lead from the higher levels within government as well.
And Fiona, you spoke about your principles that you developed. Can you tell me about those?
What we did is we focused them around a number of areas. So one of the first areas was the fact that we don't know much about this group of children. And the state has a responsibility to find out. If we don't know, it's very easy to ignore them. And this is a problem within many jurisdictions, that we just do not know how many kids are affected. We can estimate, and so within Ireland, the estimation is around 6,000 to 9,000 kids per year, but that's very much just an extrapolation. So one of our first recommendations was that the state, led by the Department of Children and Youth Affairs, should do a survey. They should seek to find out how many children are affected on an anonymised basis. And there are difficulties in finding that data because families are often quite reluctant to disclose. They fear stigmatisation, they fear engagement with authorities, and that's not surprising. So they need to be reassured that this is not about gathering data on them, it's gathering data on the numbers of children, the geographical location, the challenges they face. So that was one of the data collection issues. And the other, we want them to find out what services are being offered and being accessed, because we don't know fully, again, where those children are getting help from. We know they're probably in the system getting all sorts of different types of help, but I can list off a number of organisations that are doing little bits, but I for sure do not know every organisation that's helping this group of children. So those are the kind of first two priorities in terms of building a clear knowledge base around what the problem is. Then one of the key things we wanted to stress was that the children themselves need to be heard. It's all very well us speaking for them, but one of the key principles in children's rights is that we hear the voice of the children. And again, this is a difficult group to reach. Often parents don't want them to have, you know, to be dealt with by researchers or authorities. Sometimes the children don't even know, or parents think they don't know, that the other parent is in prison. But in order to shape and develop policies and to shape and develop services, we need to talk to those children. Those children need to be heard. And so one of the things that we made very clear was that mechanisms that are already in place need to be used to allow us to hear from those children, and that they have input into what would work for them. And then we were keen to argue for the recognition of a holistic, you know, the holistic needs of this group of children. You know, the state policy around children needs to directly name this group of children and commit to supporting them, not just in the criminal justice system, but across all situations in which they can encounter state bodies and state care. So we would, you know, we would be focusing beyond that. Pushing for multi-agency partnerships, so, you know, organisations talking to each other, working together. You know, it's not rocket science, it's difficult to structure, but these bodies are already doing it. They need to just formally recognise that this group of children are kind of important. And also strengthening monitoring frameworks. So we identified the Office of the Children's Ombudsman as a potential organisation that could provide support there. In Italy and in Croatia, the Ombudsman for Children in those jurisdictions play a very valuable role. And one of the examples that we brought back from our experience was in Italy, a memorandum of understanding has been signed between the Department of Justice the Children's Ombudsman and one of the key NGOs that work in this area to develop a kind of interdisciplinary, cross-institutional, structured approach to this group of children that will be properly monitored and assessed in terms of its implementation and outputs. And the final thing that we were keen to do is raising awareness. People don't think about this. We call the conference Unseen Unheard, and the unseen is very clear. Unless someone says, have you thought about children of prisoners? People go, no, why would I think about them? They're invisible within our society, and it's not just ours. Information needs to be provided to their group of children and their parents, but we would also encourage other organisations to think about this group, to understand their responsibilities. So, for example, the media, when the media report on criminal cases, very often they'll mention that an offender or an accused has children. There is no need for them to do that. But by mentioning their existence, you start to kind of create a spotlight which is not a positive spotlight. So one of the things about our awareness issue is that there's good awareness, but there's also harmful consequences of awareness as well. And perhaps media organisations should contemplate whether or not divulging information about, you know, Mr. So-and-so has two children aged 3 and 5, that's not relevant to his offending and taking responsibility. So we're trying to kind of push that awareness, not just general public, but also into organisations that wouldn't necessarily see themselves as being having a degree of responsibility here. We have to be very careful about the potential stigmatisation and harm that can be done to this group, who are largely powerless and have no voice, and often self-stigmatise as well, and are fearful of kind of attention. So there's a lot going on in there.
One final question. You mentioned Tim Haynes and the education aspect. Do you think the way that we train teachers and their continual professional development leaves scope for sensitizing them to the challenges that this group faces, and maybe parent imprisonment is one of several adverse childhood experiences perhaps that they're experiencing, and on what should be done in that regard?
Yes, I mean, it's a very important point that teachers are often on the front line with these children. They may not be aware that they have children in their classrooms that have experienced this. They may just be aware of behavioural issues. When teachers know, they can become a key support and a kind of key actor in these children's lives. And one of the things that Tim talked about was that it just takes one person sometimes to hear, one person to provide a safe space. That may be a teacher, it may not, but as I say, teachers are a clear kind of obvious candidate for playing that role. Now, it was interesting at the conference because one of the members of the audience raised the question. She's involved in teacher training and was very keen to kind of raise the idea that this should be put on the curriculum at the early stages in teacher training. And we would very definitely support that this should, at a minimum, be one class that they are engaged with. They're not necessarily exposed to that kind of understanding and not exposed to the harms that these children experience. By putting it on the curriculum, a teacher training phase, by putting it in the CPD, continuing education, those teachers can be exposed to the reality of what these children face. And very often, children will be judged as just being difficult. Work that's being done by families outside with teachers has shown some incredible kind of feedback from teachers going into prison, being faced with the reality of what these children face every day, and coming out and kind of taking a view of, yes, we can be a kind of key resource for these children when they look for it.
Fiona, that's great. Thank you very much.
River broke the bloodwood and the desert oak, holding wrecks and boiling diesels, steam at 45 degrees. The time has come to save this pit, to pay.
I'm joined now on the line by Ivan McCutcheon from Cork Chamber of Commerce. And Ivan, you're very welcome to Law and Justice. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about this Getting to Grips with Data Protection seminar that Cork Chamber has organised, Ivan?
Okay, well, people may or may not be familiar with the data, General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which is coming in May next year. It's something that there's quite a big public campaign around getting companies ready for it, because essentially any company that is holding personal data is going to have a lot more obligations placed on them in terms of how they obtain that, how they process it, how long they keep it, and under on what legal basis they have for using that or having it in the first place. So, and previously, a lot of data protection regulation would have applied to companies where there was a much bigger volume of data being handled. This really is going to apply to every company, and it's much broader, and the penalties are much higher. So there's a real need to get ready for it. I suppose it's been described as like the introduction of health and safety regulation in the workplace. You know, anyone really that's handling information that has people's names in it is now going to have very good habits about how they collect it and how they use it. So that's what a conference is about. A lot of awareness work has been done through the year, and I suppose we're hoping to move on more to what actually needs to be done, the actionable sort of stuff that companies need to address, and it will take time, and you know, May won't be long running around, and you know, people shouldn't miss the opportunity, I suppose, to get themselves prepared and upskill the people, introduce different policies and documentation processes and training and so on for their staff as well.
So is the goal then, Ivan, to actually, I suppose, tell companies in the Cork region or further afield, I don't know where people are, how far people are coming from to be at this event, about their duties under this piece of legislation or regulation? Is that what it's about, basically?
Yeah, definitely is. But it's also to give them support in actually...
How to do it.
How to do it, you know, because there's a lot of information has been put out about principles of data protection and possibly penalties around that, around infringement, and a lot of, you know, there have been various scares about data breaches and so on. Over the last few years, that companies are quite aware in many cases, but they don't necessarily know how to interpret the regulation because the regulation is based on sort of self. You have to demonstrate compliance. It's not like you can sort of tick a series of boxes or checklists and you're done. You really have to work it out for yourself based on the information you hold.
Right, so you police yourself that you're behaving yourself in an ethical way and in
exactly.
a legal way.
Yeah.
And how great is the demand for knowledge in this kind of area among Cork businesses, Ivan?
It seems to be very high. There's a lot of... Earlier in the year, as I said, there was a lot of interest in, yeah, okay, it's still a year off, and, well, we'll get around to it in time, and there's other priorities ahead of that. And we ran a training course earlier in the year, which certainly wasn't oversubscribed. For the seminar now, we have a waiting list, and we booked out 2 weeks ago. So, you know, we're quite surprised, really, at the level of demand, because, as I said, there have been a lot of events, but most of those events have been sort of a one-hour overview or a little bit more than that, but maybe not enough for people actually to get to grips with it. So, we think we're meeting a need that's there, because clearly the demand is there. So.
Yeah. And what type of businesses will be attending the seminar?
Well, we've targeted at SMEs, and by and large, what the businesses that are attending are mostly less than 50 employees, and mostly in the service sector, you know, whether that's hospitality or professional services or IT. Those are the kind of businesses that would have a lot of customer information. GDPR applies pretty much to every business in the sense that it also covers any information you hold about your employees. So we have them very widespread, and we have some very, you know, we have big businesses and right down to very small operations. And as I said, they're all local.
And can you tell us about some of the industry speakers and leading practitioners in data protection who will be presenting at the event?
We have a speaker coming down from the Department of Taoiseach. The Department of Taoiseach had made contact with our partners in this IT at Cork, expressing their concern at the level of, or the lack of preparedness amongst SMEs. So they were keen to see something happening, and they'll have someone there to address the seminar. And then the initial kind of opening presentation and overview and some of the most solid input will come from the Data Protection Commission themselves. So we have Dan Keyes, Assistant Data Protection Commissioner. And after that, then we'll have a panel discussion, and then the other speakers are local experts by and large. So we have Emerald Dalou, who has been really to the forefront in Cork in raising awareness and putting out information about data protection and GDPR. She has a legal background as well, as far as I'm aware. But our company is Eurocomply, and they produce software to help businesses with their compliance. We have Mary Murphy from Port Privacy. So they're consultants in the area, and Mary also runs training courses with Cork Chamber. We have
very wide ranging speakers with a variety of experience.
We have people with legal background, people with IT and security background, people who are involved in training and consulting in this area. So it covers quite a range. Yeah.
And Ivan, so the event is free, but it's fully booked out. Do you intend to run a similar seminar in the near future with the Cork Chamber of Commerce? Do you reckon?
I don't think we'll go again with this. I think as the clock ticks down, it's more and more appropriate to get down to finer levels of detail.
Okay.
And I suppose from speaking with my colleagues in the SkillNet, BizSkillNet in Cork Chamber here, their plan is to run a series of more sectorally focused GDPR training sessions. So, people will have missed maybe the chance to have this kind of overview in one day or half day, but they will have a better opportunity maybe to dig into detail and perhaps get some more relevant input at the level of their own sector. So that's the plan for the next few months then.
Okay, Ivan. Well, all the best with it. What date is the event on? You might remind our listeners.
It's on Thursday next week.
Thursday next week. It's all booked up, unfortunately. Well, yeah. All the best with that, Ivan. I hope it goes very well. It sounds fascinating. And thanks for taking the call.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Loses herself in a dreaming and sleep, and her lover's.
You're listening to Law and Justice with Jane Mulcahy. We had a few technical difficulties earlier, so we didn't play the solitary confinement segment right after Unseen Unheard. But you're going to hear now from Professor Jules Lobel, a professor in law at Pittsburgh, and Dr. Mary Rogan from Trinity College Dublin about issues related to solitary confinement.
I'm Jules Lobel. I'm a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. I have an endowed chair, and I was the president for the Center for Constitutional Rights and worked with the organization for over 30 years. It's estimated 100,000 people in solitary confinement. And I brought a case that went up to the Supreme Court challenging confinement in supermax, which is a solitary 23 hours a day in your own cell, where they just put people in the supermax with no reasons, with no process. And the Supreme Court held that they had to have due process, that you couldn't just put people in a solitary confinement for a prolonged period of time without giving them some sort of hearing. And more recently, I've been involved in a challenge to California's practice of solitary confinement, where they kept thousands of prisoners in solitary for some over a decade, some over two decades, in small cells with no windows, 23 hours a day, where they had no physical contact with anybody else, very little verbal contact with other people, and they couldn't see the outside world at all. And that's the case where the California settled, ending indeterminate solitary confinement in California. And more recently, I've been involved in the case challenging the Pennsylvania's Department of Correction holding somebody in solitary for 36 years, where the court ruled it was cruel and unusual treatment.
The California case was a class action, and the Pennsylvania case was just one specific individual. You mentioned earlier that you have to be quite strategic in this regard, and that if you're representing an individual, then you have to look for the kind of most sympathetic or extreme case that you can find. Is that correct?
Correct. And in this case, the Pennsylvania case, it was an extreme case because it was 36 years, and it was a sympathetic individual in that he hadn't committed any violent crime in prison, and he was misconduct-free for almost 20 years in prison. In California, we brought it as a class action because that case arose out of a prisoner political action, namely a nonviolent hunger strike, which actually took its inspiration in part from Bobby Sands and the Northern Irish hunger strike here in Ireland. And they had read things on that, and they decided instead of going the route of taking over the prison and holding hostages, they were going to go on a nonviolent hunger strike. And that's what got me involved in that case. And those prisoners didn't want to do it as an individual case, but as a class, because they were representing the class in their hunger strike.
And so then, Professor Lobel, what was the actual outcome in the California case?
In the California case, we brought it to court, and we were litigating in court for 4 years, and the court gave us certain favorable decisions, but we were supposed to go to a trial, which would have probably been a three-week trial. And because of a lot of pressure brought from the prisoners, brought from the media, brought from our litigation, California settled with us, and they agreed that they would end indeterminate solitary confinement, end solitary confinement for just being a gang member, which is they would put anybody in solitary who is a gang member, and they agreed to end that and to only use solitary confinement for a defined, limited period of time for a serious disciplinary violation.
Professor Mary Rogan mentioned the application of the Mandela rules here in relation to the use of solitary confinement. I presume they don't have much application in the United States?
We are trying to get them to have application, but the Mandela rules prohibit solitary confinement for more than 15 days. And in the United States, almost all prison administrators would say that's too short a time.
Right, okay. You have also been involved in litigating cases in relation to Guantanamo Bay. Can you tell me a tiny bit about that, please?
Guantanamo Bay litigation, which involved the Bush administration's putting in hundreds of suspected terrorists in Guantanamo and keeping them there in what one British judge called a black hole, a legal black hole, without any due process, with the rule of law not applying at all. And we challenged that successfully in that the Supreme Court held that you had to give them some kind of hearing. I was also involved in challenging the torture and detention of individuals in the war on the so-called war on terror, and my organization did a lot of the leading work on the, against the Bush administration's war on terror.
I'm Mary Rogan. I'm a lecturer at the Law School in Trinity College, and I'm also the principal investigator on a project examining inspection and oversight of prisons.
And Mary, you are hosting this very interesting event tonight at Trinity College Dublin on solitary confinement. Can you tell me a tiny bit about recent case law in Ireland on this issue or policy developments?
Sure. So we're seeing quite an interesting turn in the legislation, which is running in tandem with some interesting recent cases. So the key cases in the area are called Kinsella, Connolly and McDonnell, and the first two of those cases established quite a strong principle that extended periods of time in solitary confinement, probably measured in the order of extended period of months, would be in breach of the Constitution, would breach a person's right to bodily integrity, with some interesting statements that bodily integrity also incorporates psychological integrity, and that prolonged solitary confinement could interfere with that and therefore can be a breach of the Constitution. Ultimately, in the Kinsella case and the Connolly case, release wasn't ordered. They were both Article 40 habeas corpus decisions on the grounds that the court felt in both instances that the point hadn't been reached where in the Kinsella case, the point hadn't been reached where release was warranted. They found a breach of the rights. And in Connolly case, that the person was not felt to be in such a situation that he was presently, in the view of the court, in unlawful detention. They were followed by two High Court decisions in the McDonnell case, which gave quite specific orders to the court requiring them to provide the applicant in the case with access to meaningful human contact, access to opportunities to converse with others. Those decisions were overturned by the Court of Appeal in, I suppose, a decision which, if you're interested in the area of solitary confinement, is a very interesting one, and there are aspects of it, I suspect, where proponents of solitary reform would be quite disappointed. So, for example, the Court of Appeal queried whether the situation in question, which had been going on, a person was detained for 22 hours in a cell for about a year, was in fact solitary confinement because it wasn't being imposed as a form of punishment, whereas we know from the Mandela rules that the intention behind the use of solitary confinement isn't relevant to the definition. It's the fact of the detention itself being for 22 hours a day or more, being locked up in a cell. The court also expressed very strong views on the importance of deference towards the prison authorities, indicating that the separation of powers is something viewed quite seriously in the area, and that the courts will give a large degree of large margin of appreciation, in the words of the court, to the prison authorities. But it's interesting that we actually see reform coming in the form of secondary legislation. So a prison rules amendment was passed this year, which there are caveats, but it clearly states the principle that all prisoners should be getting a minimum of 2 hours a day out of cell time, and that as a principle everyone should get as much out of cell time as is possible. So it's interesting that we actually see the executive here going further than is being required by the courts. And as I mentioned in the talk, it might be an example where we see the dialogue between the judiciary and the executive about what's constitutionally permissible actually coming more from the executive side than the judicial side for a change.
You're listening to Law and Justice. I'm Jane Mulcahy, and I'm joined here now with Conor Dunn, who's the auditor of the Law Society at UCC. Hi, Conor. How are you?
Hi, Jane. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for coming in, Conor. Before we talk a little bit about the Law Society, can you tell me about studying in Denmark as part of the Erasmus programme last year, and how did you find that experience?
Oh, well, I'd absolutely love to, yeah. I had the year of my life. Basically, part of the BCL International programme, I got to study abroad in Copenhagen for the year. So basically just a fantastic culture experience where I got to travel a lot, but also got to experience the new culture of living elsewhere, experiencing a different education system where they do things somewhat differently here, where they focus a lot more on kind of home research, which really suited me, and open discussion in class. But as well, also kind of noticing the difference in culture between, say, like how they run a society, like high income tax, you know, free public healthcare, free third level education. I mean,
amazing services.
Yeah, fantastic, yeah. I mean, and as an incoming foreign student, you're very, very beneficial for myself.
Yeah.
I honestly, I've only good things about to say about the place.
And how did you choose Denmark?
It was actually only my second choice after Leiden Law School. Believe it or not, my results weren't so great in first year. Leiden was my first choice because it's one of the top law schools. Okay. But then the kind of public international basis of both of those schools were what I kind of what was interested in at the time.
Okay, and so you are currently auditor of the Law Society, and I suppose you have a very busy period now at the start of term. What type of events have you guys coming up?
Yeah, certainly very busy. I've just come from running class elections there now, and I'll be going straight back after this. At the moment, we're kind of setting up the various subcommittees to help support us, which we're encouraging all UC students to help run. I suppose the next big events that we have coming, besides a couple of the social events to help with bond, is we have our house meetings coming up.
What are they?
So house meetings are generally open discussion where we bring in a number of interesting speakers to kind of discuss a certain topic. The first one we have, and kind of a more general one, is Eamon Dunphy, the RTE football presenter and Irish Examiner writer. So he'll be doing a live podcast of the stand, hoping at least, on the 11th of October. Also, we have Helen Dixon, the Data Protection Commissioner, coming as well to discuss the implications of the breakdown of safe harbour from the EU and the US last year. Also, the European Ombudsman, Emily O'Reilly, should be coming in for a Brexit talk at some stage at the end of next year.
Very topical, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully a number of interesting events that people will engage with.
Yeah, and I believe William Fry are sponsoring or hosting an event that sounds very interesting on mental health and resilience. What can students expect from that event?
Well, so with William Fry are essentially running a networking event along with a number of other companies who are doing it in the next couple of months. But they're having a talk beforehand with Loveliest Brezzy coming in to speak beforehand. It's kind of an issue that he kind of pioneers. So he'll be discussing mental health and, you know, kind of more so in the workplace, the kind of a way that would affect law students and how to cope with stress. And then afterwards, there'll be a networking event for students to meet partners from law firms, talk about what was discussed, but also to make some contacts as well.
And will they be trying to entice people to apply for William Fry in the future? Is that part of that whole networking aspect to it?
So the applications for traineeship contracts are open at the moment for all the big firms. So it's not just William Fry, but McCann Fitzgerald, A&L Goodbody and Matheson all have confirmed dates. They don't have Brezzy come along, but there's kind of more build up on Facebook as a result. But all very, very good events where they're going to get speakers and partners to come down and talk to people and explain why they should get involved in corporate law.
And on the 25th of October, the Society will be hosting an event for authors who might like to submit work to the Cork Online Law Review. What type of an event will that be? What kind of guidance might they get?
So this is Authors Night, so it's kind of a general event that is run by the Cork Online Law Review, which is a subsidiary of the Law Society. Usually we get in quite a top-level speaker and then a number of lectures from UCC to kind of speak about referencing, you know, the flow of writing, kind of general tips.
Structure, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and it's much for, say, you know, university students to learn how to write legal essays as much as it is for, say, people who want to submit for Collar. Mm-hmm. But of course, it is a great advertising tool for Collar to get people to make people aware that they can submit their articles and get published.
Okay. And then Law Week. This didn't exist, I don't think, back in my day when I was an undergrad. It sounds exciting. It gets underway on October the 30th. What have you got planned for that?
Yeah, I'll have to remain fairly vague because we're doing some big announcements coming up. Basically, the Law Week's been around for the past kind of 5 or 6 years, as far as I'm aware. And usually we hold our law conference and the Law Ball, as well as a number of kind of legal related events and some fun social events around campus as well. So I suppose the law conference is probably the big kind of legal event that we'll have going on.
Can you tell us the theme of that, or is that too under wraps?
I'll very happily tell you the theme of that. That's been decided long ago. So the theme this year is the issue of sexual consent. There was a new act passed, kind of tightening the laws on, you know, the issue of sexual consent, giving it a new definition, and also kind of tightening the laws of, say, enticing children online.
But, okay. You know, also, so very timely and relevant stuff.
Absolutely,
to consider.
Yeah, very timely and very important as well. It's an issue we care about quite a lot. and we'll be doing a lot of work in the build up to it soon. I unfortunately can't give you any speakers at the moment, but it should be a very, very, very good event.
That's okay, Connor. You can send someone in to talk to us maybe closer to the time when you
Absolutely.
Have that all set up. Okay, thanks, Connor Dunn. I'm Jane Mulcahy. This is Law and Justice. Hopefully you will tune in 2 weeks' time. All the best. Bye bye.
Commitment to producing community-themed documentaries, Cork Campus Radio presents